This is Maxine Ray conducting an interview for the Civil Rights Project, sponsored by the Kentucky Oral History Commission of the Kentucky Historical Society. I am interviewing Mr. Howard Bailey here at his office on the campus of Western Kentucky University. Today's date is October the 23rd, 2000, and we will be talking about civil rights in the community, city where he was born and raised in. Mr. Bailey, tell me your full name, please.
My name is Howard Eugene Bailey.
Can you give me your date of birth?
My date of birth, I was born March 4th, 49, in Middlesboro, Kentucky.
What's your parents' name?
My father's name was Lawrence Leroy Bailey, and my mom's name is Willie Jean Bailey.
Do you have any sisters or brothers?
I have one sister who is Gwendolyn Loomy.
Are you married?
I'm married with Kayla Ann Bailey with one son, Malcolm Dominic.
Now tell me about where your schooling. Where did you go to school?
Okay. I went to school in southeastern Kentucky in Bell County and grew up in Middlesboro, which was the larger community in Bell County, with Pineville, Kentucky being the county seat.
The community where you were born in, was it integrated or was it a segregated community?
Middlesboro was a unique community in that it was in some cases one could say it was somewhat integrated, in that as a community of at that time probably about 12,000-13,000 people, with African Americans living in three different sections of the community. And I say that was different because in most southern towns you had all the African Americans lived in one section of the town. But in Middlesboro, there were four different African American neighborhoods, and they all touched and were intertwined with white neighborhoods.
After you finished your schooling there, where did you go to college?
I'm a graduate of Western Kentucky University. I finished high school in Middlesboro in 1966, graduating from Middlesboro High. Actually, I spent my last 2 years at Middlesboro High. The previous years were spent at Lincoln High, which was what was known then as the colored school.
What's your occupation?
I'm Dean of Students and Associate Vice President for Student Affairs.
Now, when you were in high school and all, did you face any kind of racial tensions or prejudices while you were in school? From any of your teachers or anything?
Well, I don't, because we had a very unique situation in as a little coal mining town in the mountains, in that because the kids knew one another, because I lived in the middle of the block in my neighborhood and directly across the street and two doors down from me were white families. You could go another block where my grandmother and aunt lived, and they both had white families that lived on either side of them. So as kids, we grew up knowing one another. Every now and then there would be altercation where we might call each other a name or two, but the next day we'd be out in the street playing ball again with one another. So yes, there were, we knew, we were racially conscious and realized that there was differences, but not compared to what I've seen in other communities.
Well, tell me a little bit about your textbooks. In your school, did you all have them?
Now, from the educational standpoint, there was clearly a difference. The white kids, even though we lived intermingled and intertwined in the neighborhood, they went to one school, we going to another. White kids were picked up on the bus and bused to school. We walked or your parents had to take you to school, so there was no bus system for black kids. As it was in our case, we walked past the white school to get a mile further down the road to get to the black school. So it would have been much more convenient for us to have walked three blocks to the white high school from the textbooks and materials. We got the white school's hand-me-downs. We could always tell when they had gotten new books because the custodial staff at their school would bring pickup trucks with textbooks in them and drop them off at our school. And literally at times when I say drop them off, I can remember that occasionally they would shovel the books out of the pickup trucks with coal shovels and just literally dump them on the ground outside the school building. So our teachers and principals would go out and gather them up and tape up the books that were in real bad shape and clean them up. And they would, like I said, they would bring them over in pickup trucks that had an assortment of things, including coal dust in them sometime. So our material was always pretty suspect and limited.
Yeah. Well, because what kind of teachers did you all have? Did you have teachers that were really interested in teaching?
The dedication of the teachers is what caused us to be able to prosper. And they ranged in terms of backgrounds and skills. We had some teachers that had outstanding educational credentials from some outstanding schools around the country that they had left Middlesboro, or some of, in a few cases, there were some husband-wives that maybe the wife left Middlesboro and went away to school and married, and she and the husband both returned as school teachers, or vice versa. And then there were some that were not well trained. We had a few teachers that had one, maybe 2 years of college, and there's a difference in those classrooms. And while looking back on it, those are the teachers that had the most difficult time conveying the information to us, but they tried hard and they were respected in the community.
But do you feel that your education was limited because of the teachers with the 2 years education?
We were led to believe that our education was limited, but looking back on it, knowing that the teachers what we didn't have in terms of textbooks, what we didn't have in terms of lab equipment for biology or chemistry. Being in a small community, we went out on the creek bank and had class right there in. We had our own biology lab at the edge of the school ground. And they, I remember the old mimeograph machines that they would run off material for us to subsidize the books. So when we were integrated and which actually meant we went into the white school my junior year in high school, we as kids were very fearful that the white kids were smarter than we were. It didn't take but a few days for us to realize that our teachers had prepared us to where we were quite capable and were quickly seen as some of the better students. Some of our kids, yes, they were not good students, but those are the ones that weren't good students in the colored school. Those that were good students at the colored school were good students when integration came about. Were some of the teachers questionable and suspicious of us? Yes, they were.
Did you have any, were the teachers, how did they treat you? Were they anxious to call on you in class to do classwork?
It varied. Some of the teachers had known, again, because of the way the community was laid out, some of those teachers had known us as children playing in the same neighborhood all of our lives. We had an integrated, everything but football, we had an integrated parks and recreation system to where in baseball and basketball for boys, which at that era that was primarily for boys, we played on the same baseball teams and we traveled to the different towns. And in fact, we had a team that went to Little League World Series. I wasn't on that team, it was a little bit ahead of my time, but that's when the parents of black and white kids, they went to Pennsylvania, I think, for the final. So we knew each other. We traveled together. We played on the ball field together. We just, when class time came, went to separate schools, which as kids we thought was rather foolish. So some of the teachers knew us. Some of the teachers were uncomfortable with our presence, and we could detect that, but so it varied.
Well, how did the city officials handle integration? Did they try to fight it? Were there any sit-ins or marches before?
I found out about in latter years that there were some city officials that were, it could have happened sooner. We integrated in 1964, which is a clear decade after the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision. So that some, along that decade, there was obviously some foot dragging going on, some people that avoided it. The excuse that we were given was that the white school was overcrowded, and it was. And during the early 60s, the black students were, black families in general, were leaving Middlesboro and a lot of South Central, Southeastern Kentucky, during the Northern migration. I have many, many families. One member of the family would move into Gary or Fort Wayne, or many of the Midwestern factory towns, and found employment. By the following year, school would be out, the dad would come home and move the family away. So the number of black kids was dwindling drastically. So by 1964, the actual integration of kids in the same classroom took place. 2 years prior to that, in 62, and this is, has some racial greed, I guess I'd call it. In 1962, Middlesboro integrated its athletic program, well, not just athletic, but school activities, extracurricular activities were integrated. To where our school had numbers had gotten so small that we couldn't man a football team anymore. So that had stopped, I think, in about 59. But we had an outstanding basketball, baseball, track, state choir. So in 62, the decision was made to integrate the extracurricular activities. So we were, for the first time, bused as student athletes over to the white school to be on the then Middlesboro High athletic teams. And needless to say, Middlesboro High, which had been a very mediocre athletic program, flourished and boomed immediately. So that's how it actually started, was in 62. They integrated the extracurricular. So the bus then would show up at our school in the afternoons. You didn't get a ride home, but if you were going to the white school to take part in some extracurricular activity, you got a bus ride over to the white school.
So you'd have to get back home the best way you could.
You still had to get home the best way you could. Yeah.
But what about movie theaters? Did y'all have a movie theater? Was it?
There were two movie theaters in the community at that time, and I'm trying to remember when they were integrated. Like, I know you're aware of what was usually done with movie theaters, is the black people had to sit in the balcony. And the most, one of the largest of the two theaters had two balconies, so we had to sit in the upper balcony. And the mid balcony was only used if the theater got overcrowded. I really can't remember the year that the theater was integrated. Of course, we many times would go from one balcony to another as teenage boys and purposely sit where we were not supposed to, just to wait for the ushers to come and tell us to leave and cause commotion, and they'd call the police and then we'd leave. We'd go back to the upper balcony. But I'm going to say that integration of the theaters probably came right around the same time as the school integration. And even years after, a couple of years after it was integrated, I can remember we as teenagers refused to go and sit in the white area. We preferred going up and sitting in the balcony, and that was probably because we were being just a little bit deviant.
Yeah. Well, before integration, did your parents give you any kind of instructions, you know, before going to the high schools or going to the...
Yes. Well, let me go back and say something that I do remember about the theater. My mother is not African American. My mother is a Melungeon, and that's a whole nother story. So we as what was then called mixed kids, what would now be looked upon as biracial. I can remember as a small child, when I couldn't even see up to the ticket window, that my mother would carry my sister and I to the movies. Of course, our prices were cheaper, but we had to go, we couldn't go through the theater. The Negro balcony, you bought your ticket and went around the side of the building and went up a long flight of steps that was adjacent to the fire escape. We went up we went up the steps to get to that upper balcony. And I can remember my mother walking up to the counter, the ticket window, and them, and she would ask for one adult, two children's tickets. And they would sell her tickets to the white section. And then the ticket window person would, when we would walk away, would then notice that she had brown children and would call her back and would be very short with her and make her give them the tickets back. And then they would charge us less, of course, but would issue us black tickets. And so they would, when they saw the color of her kids, they would then make her give them those tickets back and make sure that we knew that we had to go outside the theater and around the back and up the stairwell.
Oh my goodness. Did you ever question your mom about that? Why that
well,
happened?
Well, at that time I didn't. I just knew it was different, and that was some of the early years of knowing that we were different and were treated differently. But we dealt with some of that in her family also. And as I said, that's a whole nother story. Yeah, but your question was about...
Did your parents...
prepare us for the integration. Mm-hmm. Yes, I can remember my dad standing in the... My dad was custodian at the post office and then later got into the mail aspect of it. And the post office was one block from the white high school. And undoubtedly there had been adult conversation in the communities as to what's going to happen when the kids go to school together. And my dad said, now I'll be at work. And if anything happens, you just get up and leave and come down to the post office. I don't want you to get in any fights or don't say anything out of the way to anyone. You just get up out of the classroom. If you see something getting started, you leave and you come to the post office and ask for me. And my dad had the post office locker room was in the basement. He said, you just go to the basement and stay down there, and then I'll come and get you. And we as kids, and by this time, I was on the football team and track team, and we'd been playing on the same team for 2 years. We couldn't figure out what our parents were so worried or concerned about. These are the kids that we've been on bus trips and had even at times the white kids had fought the other teams. Now we went into some communities as an integrated team that we were treated in a very hostile way. But the white kids on our team had fought with us against other white kids that called us names. So we thought it was kind of amusing and comical that our parents were so worried on this first opening day. And you could see the black parents, some I guess looking back on it, might not have even were late to work that day because they walked to the bus stops. In my case, I lived, I found out, inside the bus zone, so I had to walk anyway. I was a half a block inside the bus zone. So, but parents walked up the street and went to school with kids that normally at teenage level, we just grabbed your sandwiches and took off. But our parents were obviously tense and concerned. There were no incidents.
What about the churches? Were there any kind of preparation meetings in the churches or anything for you all getting ready to?
there was one church, or one of the large black Baptist church, there had been a meeting, I understand, in the basement the Sunday afternoon before the first day of school. But we as teenagers were pretty much oblivious to this. Now, we knew what racism was. We knew when we went into a department store and how we were treated. There were hotels in our town. There was one black hotel, so we knew that only black people had to stay in the one black hotel, and we couldn't stay in the other hotels and restaurants. And we felt racial discrimination from that standpoint. We knew that my father and one other man were the only two black employees at the post office as government employees. And school teachers were, of course, in a segregated school, and they got rid of most of the black school teachers when they integrated. I guess that was the piece of it that drew our attention. The elementary school teachers, were offered jobs, and I look back though. They probably had the best credentials. Some of the high school teachers, because we got some teachers that only would stay 1 or 2 years and move on that were not from that area. They were always graduates of Kentucky State. They'd come, that'd be their first teaching job. They would live in the home of some black, usually an elderly female, because there were no apartments available for them to live in. And our principal, who had outstanding credentials, both as previously as a coach and was principal at that time, he was probably in his latter years prior of his career, but we resented and felt it was wrong that he was made the head custodian of the maintenance department. Our principal was made one of the head maintenance department supervisors. That was the job that they offered him, because it was obvious they weren't going to make a black man a principal at that time. So the racism was subtle. It was clearly there, but subtle. But amongst the kids, we didn't feel much of it. We socialized where we wanted to. And again, I probably saw it from a pretty broad perspective as on the football team, because we played with these kids every day. You know, you get down in the mud and fight and kick, and you play football, and you find out that you got to depend on that white kid and he's got to depend on you, you get over that.
Yeah. So then you all didn't have any kind of marches or sit-ins or anything doing?
We went, I remember one time we as a bunch of kids, there was a Woolworth, what they call it, the fountain. Yeah, 10-cent store had a little restaurant, 10 or 12 stools. You could go and buy a hamburger and whatever there. We decided that they had said, you know, that was always segregated. Well, a bunch of us decided, we didn't tell our parents, we decided we're going to go up there and sit down and order a meal. And we did. Lady was very upset with us doing so, but she waited on us. She made it clear she didn't want us there. but she waited on us. So we lost our city, and really it didn't work.
It flopped.
Yeah, it kind of flopped, because undoubtedly somebody had told her, go ahead and wait on them and don't let any problem take place. So our community was one where I think as I said, there was subtle racism, some of it pretty blatant, and I look back on it, but there were never any. We saw tension every now and then. There would be a group of white young adults, 20 and above, would get drunk and maybe ride through our neighborhood and blurt out some racial statements, slurs, and I would see the young black men in our neighborhood the next few nights would kind of wait and see if they'd come back, and they usually had their 22 rifles or pistols or whatever, and when somebody would come through our neighborhood maybe and shoot out the street light. And I know that some of the young men in the community would wait for them for a night or two, and would, I even think that one time there was, they shot out a street light in our neighborhood, and some guys were waiting on them, and they shot into the car. No one was injured. We saw racial discrimination among police officers. I guess my first couple of experiences with police officers were to see police officers pick up black women in the community. Our neighborhood had a couple of local drunks, both male and female. We saw once as kids pick up a white female that was staggering down the street, picked up, and they arrested her, and we as kids on our bicycles followed for a few blocks to notice that they didn't take her to jail. They took her down behind an abandoned warehouse. We were afraid to get too close, but looking back on it now, we're pretty sure they probably raped her before they took her to jail. In the sixth grade, I was with a group of kids that we'd come in contact with some white kids that lived in a section of town where there were no blacks. And as I said, blacks lived in four different sections of town, but they lived in the outskirts. And we came in encounter with them on the railroad track one afternoon, and somebody called us a nigger. And it was four or five boys, and we started picking up those big limestone, what we called earth apples, and started, there ended up being a pretty good rock fight. There was one kid in our group, his name was Robert Beatty, and a lot of people in the community got the Beatty family and the Bailey family confused, and we were close friends, and I guess even for a while kind of looked alike, about the same color. Robert was a good baseball player, and Robert could throw twice as far as I could. He threw and hit one of the kids right smack in the nose. They were throwing at us, we were throwing at them, and he nailed one of them. He caught her right across the nose, and I guess broke the kid's nose. Well, someone identified us as that was the Bailey boy. Well, the police came to the school, to our school the next day, and came to the door of the sixth grade. I guess they probably gone to the principal first, I don't know, but came to our classroom, and the teacher went out and came back and said, Howard, you need to come out in the hallway. Well, when I went out into the hallway, I'm sixth grade. Great big, robust police officer, name was Shelby. He reached and grabbed me and puts handcuffs on me. Well, I stand in the sixth grade, handcuffed, and then he starts questioning me. And he has these two white kids with him to identify if I were the one that had thrown the rock. Well, they said, no, I wasn't the one. But in the meantime, I'm in the hallway of the Colt room, handcuffed in the sixth grade for something I didn't do. They said, no, he's not the one. As it was, Robert Beatty was absent that day. So they opened the classroom door and let them stand in the door and look to see if they saw the one that they were looking for that had hit them. But I was there throwing. There wasn't any doubt about that. I just wasn't good enough to hit anybody. And only because the white kids said, no, it's not him, that they take the cuffs off of me. And I, looking back, of course, I was frightened to death. I would question whether that police officer would have dealt with a white kid that way. They were clearly trying to frighten me, and they were successful, but I couldn't admit doing something that I didn't do. Yeah.
How did your parents take this? Were there any?
The teacher told my parents and told them that I wasn't a part of it. My dad scolded me for stay off going around that railroad track and just leave those kids alone. And that was pretty much the end of it. But I would say that since the teacher and my went to the same church, I would guess there were conversations in private that I didn't know about, but there wasn't anything much anybody could do about it.
Did you all have an NAACP there?
No.
Were there any black elected officers, city officials, or anything, police or anything like that?
None to many, many years afterwards. Mm-hmm. I think our community was one that probably wasn't even black led by ministers much. My dad, by working for the Postal Service, his colleague there and a few of the school teachers were the only educated black people in town, even though my dad, as I said, started out as a custodian with college background. Those were kind of the people that spoke on behalf of our community. My aunt, who was a retired school teacher, I can remember her doing so. But there were never any people that held any political office. My dad was, I guess, the first black city commissioner, but that was in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay. There have been some since then. Mm-hmm. But after he retired from the post office, you can't run for political office as a government employee, but after he retired, he ran for office of one. So I grew up members of one of the respected Negro families. And that has its pros and cons, and that you were resented sometimes by other blacks, but we were school teachers, and my aunt was a registered nurse at the hospital, and we didn't have much more than many others. But it took a while for me to realize, I primarily became aware of it from the resentment from some of the other black kids, that we were considered of the good Negro families. But that was
it. Okay, well, did your aunt work at the hospital there in the Bell County?
Yes,
yes.
She was, for many years, in fact, my aunt delivered me. And that was probably due to racism, in that when my mother went into labor, there was a white female that went into labor at the same time. So the one doctor that was on call at the hospital that night went and delivered the white woman's baby. So my aunt was the registered nurse on duty that night. So she delivered me.
Did your mom work outside the home?
Yes, my mom worked as a domestic maid, whatever the proper term is for that. Once I went to school, and I went to school at age 5, and commuted across the, not only the county line, was also the state line when you went west. I went to a one-room school in Claiborne County, Tennessee. It was a little mining camp town called Fork Ridge. And it was 1 through 8 grades. Had electricity, but no plumbing, outhouses, no running water. We got water from the well down at the settlement. And that's where I started school, because there was segregated schools there, but my mom and dad socialized with this couple that they taught in this little mining camp town, just across the state line, I guess it's 6-8 miles away from town. So we rode, they put me in the car, and I rode with the teacher to that little school, and that, because Tennessee didn't follow your birth certificates, and at age 5, if you could go to school, if you could keep up, they'd let you go. So that allowed my mother to go to work, get a job. So she cleaned houses until probably I was in high school, and then she got a job as a custodial worker in JCPenney's, and went from there to, after a couple of years, she stopped cleaning and they made her a clerk. So she retired as a sales clerk for Penny's. But most of her life she was cleaning houses.
Good. Did you all get any black history classes in your high school there?
There weren't black history, but our black teachers incorporated black accomplishments, black involvement, history and science, everything, every subject we had. Those teachers that had come from those historical black schools, of course, to get their degrees, they incorporated that. When we took the literature book and studied Charles Dickens and several others. God, he stands out because I thought it was one of the most boring writers. And I know he's considered a scholar and a great, some of the greatest works known, but to me was extremely boring. But when we had that, we would also have Langston Hughes and McCain and many of those people that was handed to us, their work was handed to us on mimeograph. Or the teacher would stand before us and read from black publications or that they owned themselves, or a few that were in our library that had been donated over the years. Or you would be given the book and you would read X number of lines, then the book was handed to the kid behind you, and it went, that book was carried throughout the classroom. But we got in science the same thing. My grandfather was a Tuskegee graduate, and George Washington Carver was his chemistry teacher. So we got a lot of it at home also. Yeah.
That's great, great. Well, how do you think that race relations and integration and all is doing in your community now? Do you think it's changed for the worst or the best?
I think there's things are there in some senses from a social aspect are relatively positive. I don't see professional opportunities for blacks there, but at the same time, because Southeast Kentucky has so little to offer, it's difficult to imagine that a black educated person would settle there and find that a place they want to live. Would I accept a job in Middlesboro, Kentucky now? Not short of starvation. I just can't imagine going back there to live. So there are no black professionals except for four or five school teachers. They were elementary school teachers. In fact, I drafted a letter in support of an ex-classmate, black female, that has gotten her degree over the years as a non-traditional student, but did not get a degree in education. And there are some in the community that have taken issue with the superintendent and the school board that in the history of Middlesboro High School, there has never been a high school black teacher, high school or junior high. There are four, five, six black female teachers in elementary level, but there's never been one in the high school or junior high. And they pressed the superintendent and school board in the last year to the point that the school board requested some kind of exception for this female that she might be able to go in. I think she's got a background in computers or something of that nature, to where she could get a teaching certificate, an emergency or some kind of teaching certificate. But there are no black professionals in the community to press the parameters. The kids' opportunities are there for them. You know, you see a lot of interracial dating and marriages and from a social level, but economically it is no.
Who were some of you all's civil rights leaders, idols during that time, you know?
On a national basis?
In national, local, or local, or in which way?
I guess on a local level, my aunt was one, Mary Lee Worthington, my mother's sister, who as I said, they're Melungeons, but that made them different from whites, and they identified with the black community. She worked in political parties and press for change and things of that nature. There was a couple of ministers, but then I guess my dad and some of the school teachers on a national basis, we, like all others, looked at Martin Luther King. Don't know that I can remember a national figure before Martin Luther King until I came to college. You know, people like Jesse Jackson and others, Jesse at that time was still in college himself. I don't, we looked at, I guess, athletes. I was a Cleveland Brown fan. One of our TV stations, we watched professional football every Sunday, and seemed like we could always get a Cleveland Browns game, which meant we got to watch Jim Brown as a big-time athlete. Basketball, there was Bill Russell and Wilt the Stilt. So Sunday afternoon was to sit in front of the TV and watch black professional sports. That was our outlet. That there were, if you had great skills, that you could get there. Nat King Cole, Ella Fitzgerald. I can remember James Brown, the Supremes, Jackie Wilson, and people like that hitting the Ed Sullivan Show. That was one of the few shows that in American Bandstand you would see black. Temptations were coming along, and people that didn't have television would all go, adults and children alike would come and fill the living room of those that had a television when we heard that there was going to be a black person on TV.
Can you think of anything else you want to say that I haven't asked you? How was segregation or integration when you got to college? Did you face any kind of racial tensions during that?
We saw some. I guess me coming to college was, while there were college graduates in my family, my sister was at Tennessee State, had already been there 2 years when I came to Western. And I came kind of as a fluke. I'd never seen Bowling Green in my life to the day my parents pulled up and dropped me off at West Hall and then said, well, we're going to Nashville to see your sister before we go back home. Well, that was my college orientation right there. And I came almost as a dare. There was a black kid on the football team with me that was an outstanding athlete, ended up going to UK. We very much regret because he died up there due to a football accident that we questioned whether it was an accident. But he was recruited by Western, and he came here and told me about Western. And I had in the previous year seen Clem Haskins and the Dwight and the Smith boys on TV in an NCAA game. So I knew there were black athletes here. So I came here. I remember going to the guidance counselor's office asking for an admissions application for Western State College. And she looked at me and said, I don't know. And this was some of that subtle racism you saw. She said, I don't know whether you're really the type of material that you need to try to go to a school like that. You might want to consider Kentucky State. Well, my dad had attended Kentucky State, had a cousin that was at Kentucky State then. We had tasted integration. We had we were feeling civil rights. I said, no, that's where I want to go. If you can't get me one, I'll have to write out for it. She eventually gave it to me, but she also recommended that she said, if you're wanting to go that part of the state, you might ought to look at Western Kentucky Technical School in Paducah. It was the Black Technical School, which you're probably familiar with.
Yeah, but I was going to say.
Because she was still trying to tell me I didn't belong at a white school. Well, that was just, I was hell-bent that I was going there. Even though I never laid eyes on it, didn't know where it was even, but I was going there. But when I got to Western, we saw discrimination here on campus. Saw it in the community because as I came, ironically, in the first critical mass of black kids that hit Western's campus. Before then, there had been just the athletes and a few kids that lived in boarding houses along State Street, or the Frank Moxleys and the Miss Mundys that commuted in here for graduate classes and left. But other than a few of the athletes that lived on campus, there hadn't been any real mass of kids. So we showed up, there were probably 75, 80 freshmen. Well, we outnumbered all the other black students twofold or more when we showed up that year. Like I said, Clem and Dwight and Greg had been seen on TV, so this was thought to be the promised land because there were no other black athletes being recruited scholarship in the state of Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you first came here, did you get to stay on campus, or did you have to?
I did stay on campus. Applied late. Was first turned down, and they didn't have a room for me. And they sent back, of course, at that time you had to put your race on everything. They sent me a listing of Negro boarding houses in Bowling Green, that I might want to contact one of those boarding houses and get a room. Well, my dad then said, well, you're just going to Tennessee State with your sister. I looked back on it, and there was no way he's going to be able to pay out-of-state tuition for both of us on janitor's job, but he said, they don't want you down there, just go ahead. And I said, I don't want to go down there. I'd been to Tennessee State, but didn't want to be down there mainly because my sister was there. Mm-hmm. Didn't even know Bowling Green was that close to Nashville because we always went to Nashville by way of Knoxville and over. But Dad told a man in the community that was a fishing buddy with Dero Downey. This man owned a clothing store in town that I wanted to go to Western. He said, well, I know somebody down there. So he went to see, he called Dero Downey, and I guess Dero got me a room, because I, not long after that, got a notice that there was a room. And I remember my dad made me take a shower one afternoon, clean up, put on clean clothes to go up and thank Mr. Campbell for helping me out. I didn't want to go do it, but I didn't have a choice. I knew I had to go do it. When I got here, I found out that what was going on was that Western said they only assigned black kids rooms if they had a pair, because they want to make sure that they put you in the room together. And I must have been the odd man out. So they had just allowed my application to lay dormant until another black kid applied. So I probably would eventually have gotten a room, but they weren't going to assign me until they knew that they had another black kid coming, because they weren't going to have any odd black kids. So they roomed us in certain sections of the halls, and they scattered us so there wouldn't be too many of us in any one building. It took us a while to figure that out, but as you got to know other black kids, you would notice that in Bemis Lawrence, that all the black kids were in the 15 room. 215, 315, 415, 515, all of them were in the 15 room. That meant that the staff knew where the black kids were all the time, and there were never too many of us together. I was in West Hall, and in West Hall, everyone was in 101 and 103 all the way up. And like I said, it didn't take too long for us to realize all of us were lined up. So if there was a problem, and I later on had a hall director tell me that we did that and we were told to do that, if there was a problem, we could get to you all. We knew where all the black kids were. You didn't have to go to a roster that you knew where they were supposed to be.
Oh my goodness.
So, but we found it in the classroom. There are people still teaching here that I had as instructors that were racially negative toward me. I can remember being a moment or two, the bell was ringing as I was stepping into the classroom one day, and the instructor said, our professor, he's a renowned professor now, said, well, class, I guess we can start now that our black member is here, to emphasize that I was late. You got comments like that from time to time. There were people that were very nice to us, but there were people that made it clear that they tolerated us. I can remember studying for an exam with a white friend, and we got a hold of the test. So actually we cheated. And I know we had the same answers because we worked at it together. He got an A, I got a D. And I could never challenge that teacher that my answers were right because we had done something we weren't supposed to do. But I knew that it was racism that caused that to happen because the white kid got credit for all the right answers. And I did. I know we both went in there with the same cheat sheet. We all had the same answers. So, yeah, I knew it was going on.
Well, I want to thank you for your time and thank you for letting me interview you.
Sure.
And
I enjoyed it, as always.
Good. Good. Thank you.
We saw Middlesboro was a little different in that we did have the interaction among the races. But as athletes, when we went out into other communities, we had the first integrated team in that area of the state. We went into places like Carbon, which is still the hotbed of racism in the state of Kentucky. Still no. When we went into Carbon and we found out it was the first time that Middlesboro had beat Carbon in a decade. That's when the Bird boys that went on to UK and when I think one of them went into the pros were there. Mm-hmm. And we dressed many times in the school gymnasium, and they carried our clothes and our duffel bags back and put them in a truck so that when the game was over, we literally ran, black and white, to the bus and got on the bus and would leave immediately. We never got to, or few times that we were in a town that we could stop and eat a meal. We I can remember leaving places like Carbon and Lynn Camp and some of the parts of the, that area mm-hmm. with our uniforms and coats would tell you, no one takes your helmet off. We rode the bus in our uniforms, helmet included, because the adults would throw rocks at the school bus.
Adults?
Would throw rocks at the school bus and break the windows out. And we had fights on the field. And I guess that was another reason that we had a relationship with our fellow white classmates, because I can remember some of them. One of his kids, two Medley brothers from No Town. That was a part of town that black people didn't go in Millsboro, who fought side by side with me when white kids from Carbon on the football, on the field would call us niggers. Mm-hmm. And we'd end up in a brawl sometimes with some of the, in some of those communities. And it was funny that one of the Medley boys would say, "You don't call my black friend that," and would tear into folks. Sometimes they would fight before we would. So we developed a camaraderie, but in some of the communities we went into, we went to Lynn Camp as a junior varsity team, and the constables and the local sheriff stopped the game shortly after halftime, after third quarter started. When we would go into a huddle to call the play, people in the stands and on the sidelines would throw rocks at us.
These are the adults.
These are the adults that went to the ball games. So we had an integrated team and we were good. Mm-hmm. We went to the, kind of as Bowling Green High, we went to the state, I think 3 out of the 4 years that I played. And, but we went into towns to where we had to leave on the bus. And that went all the way to Fort Thomas Highlands, up just below Cincinnati, because there were still very few black people in that part of the state. We beat them on their field in a game one night, and the people came out on the field and mobbed us, and they took the police to get us to our bus. And when we got to our bus, there were very few windows that had not been broken out. And I can never remember when we went to a white school that didn't have black kids that we ever got to change clothes. We always rode back, no matter how far. If it was 100 miles away, we still rode back in our uniform with our helmet on, because we would go through down the highway, and there was a mountainous area on 25E called Booger Mountain, and that's where the adults would go up on the hillside. The bus would be in those low gears, having to go up that mountain, so the bus would be going relatively slow when it went through there. We would see, when we would leave the parking lot, adults get in their cars and take off and speed up the mountain. And they'd get up there and wait for the bus and be struggling gear-wise mm-hmm. going through those hills and throw at us and break the windows out. And we'd sit with our helmets on, and the bus would get egged, and we were treated very hostile as young kids when we went outside the community. So when we got home, our white kids knew what prejudice was. They experienced it. They're with us. I just thought we might want to share that.
That's good. Well, let me thank you again then for this interview.
Sure.